This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, Irirangi Tumotu, MPR.
Kia ora and welcome to Reserved Recommendations. This is a radio show and podcast about great trash and difficult art. My name is Hugh, I am the host of the show, and I'd just like to take this opportunity to put in a really mild content warning for the show as a whole. Sometimes our recommendations on the show are reserved just because the thing that we're talking about is in some way not good. However, sometimes we're talking about aspects of art or artists that may be confronting for some people. Check the episode description for more details, and do be aware of your listening environment. Kia ora, editing Hugh from the future here. A quick announcement before we start this week's episode. Here at Manawatu People's Radio, we recently discovered that the process that we thought was archiving episodes to save server space was in fact merely hiding them. Accordingly, we have reversed this for a number of our shows, and Reserved Recommendations is one of those. So, a complete backlog of all audio episodes of the show is now available through the website npr.nz/show/reserved, and wherever you manage to find the show on your favorite podcast app as well. I might still videofy old episodes just for the fun of it, but that's no longer going to be a major focus of my time going forward. Now, on with the show. This evening, it gives me very great pleasure to introduce Elizabeth Little. Good evening, Elizabeth. How's it going?
Good evening. It's good to be here. Thank you.
Wonderful. Wonderful. We are talking about kind of one of my favorite things to discover, which is like a really weird 70s movie that has incredibly big ideas that the reach maybe outstrips its grasp just a tiny bit. We're talking about the movie Phase 4. And the immediate thing of note about this for me when you suggested it and I looked it up is it's directed by Saul Bass, and I thought, the titles guy.
Yes, yeah.
And it turns out like this movie is kind of partly responsible for that reaction, right? Like it's the movie that meant that he is kind of only the titles guy.
Yeah, kind of. It's his only feature-length production.
So how did you come across it?
I mean, I'm fascinated by like horror and science fiction of all kinds. So I will often go sort of dredging up old films and books and interesting related media, particularly when it is things that are a little bit unconventional, a little bit weird. So I can't actually remember when I first saw Phase 4 now, but I know some years back I tracked it down on DVD and watched it again. And it's just, I think it's an incredible movie, which is very much like overlooked. And I don't know if it's as misunderstood now as perhaps it was at the time, but certainly at the time of its release, there was a whole kind of like marketing issue and the stuff around it that we'll probably get into, which is one of the reasons why it ended up becoming Saul Bass's only feature production.
Yeah, because now I may have this wrong, but it was sort of marketed as a creature feature, right? Like a monster movie almost.
Yeah, absolutely. Like a B movie creature feature. People would have gone into this based off of, I mean, like the ridiculous thing as well is like he's the poster guy, he's the title guy. You know, he's the guy who does the marketing for all of these other films, and he wasn't allowed to market his own film. And the studio marketed it as this like B movie creature feature. It's going to be like action packed, scare a minute. Go to the cinema with a load of popcorn, and it's not that kind of movie at all. It's very much like a Jodorowsky esque, Stanley Kubrick.
So if you haven't seen it, and odds are that you haven't, the central conceit is that ants appear to be acting strangely. So two scientists set up an incredibly high-tech station to study a particular colony of ants. And from that point on, the movie is kind of half about them and half about the ants. And all of the time that it's about the ants and their plans, what you get is some genuinely gorgeous, like, photography of ants running around and doing stuff, which must have been quite technically challenging to pull off. And it's
The macro photography is incredible. Sorry.
Absolutely. And it's all scored during the points where they have ants shot, and they're sort of implying that they're talking to one another. They do that with 70s synthesizer music. And so the entire effect is like very strange and kind of psychedelic and of its time.
Yeah, absolutely. I really enjoyed for those bits as well that, like, there are like a few points in the film where you do get a bit of voiceover kind of describing what they're doing, like mostly at the very beginning, when you kind of get some, like, mostly like diegetic kind of recordings of Dr. Hubbs sort of describing the initial behavior of the ants and what kind of alerted them to what was going on. But most of the time when you get these like macro photography bits with like the synthesizer music that you're talking about there, it is purely just visual. And there is like an element of storytelling and what these ants are doing. You get things like where they're like lining up like other ants for what seems like graves or like to like some kind of like burial or funeral ceremony. You have this like communication between them. But it's all very much like, I mean, I guess it comes back to like Saul Bass's work in like graphic design, where like, one of his famous quotes is like, design is thinking made visible. So you have the behavior of these ants telling the narrative, which is just really fascinating. It must have been incredibly difficult for them to actually set that, like the ants are fantastic little actors.
Yeah. It's really cool. I think like, because I one of the things that happened to this movie as a consequence of, you know, the mismarketing and I think executive meddling was that the ending was cut down. It lost about 4 minutes, and I went and tracked the original ending down. We could sort of talk about the ending more, but a bit, I guess, later on. But the thing that struck me about it is that the ending. Have you watched Evangelion?
Yes.
Yeah. So notoriously, the last couple of original episodes of Evangelion become kind of impressionistic. And if you're expecting like giant robot battles, they are very disappointing. I think they're good, but you know, people were not pleased at the time. And similarly,
yeah, I do too. And yeah, it's very similar.
The last 5 minutes of this movie is a lot of like tiny human silhouettes running through enormous hand-drawn Saul Bass mazes and things. And I think a lot of the success or failure for any given viewer is going to be how able you are to pick up what Saul Bass is putting down for you.
Yeah, I think so. It's wild to me as well that they cut that like 4 minutes out of the original theatrical release. I guess they were, they realized how they'd marketed this film and perhaps were worried that audiences weren't going to understand that or follow that or were not going to react well to that. But by removing that and then pitching it as a B movie, you've basically given people like an incredibly slow burn, quite perhaps boring sort of scientific research movie about ants that then just doesn't even have the payoff at the end. So it's, I don't know, it's just wild that they decided to do that.
Yeah, because, I mean, one of the things that, you know, if the movie had been given, I don't know how you would market it correctly, but if it had been pitched as what it is, which is a kind of slow science fiction movie, which kind of calls into question ideas about like human primacy as an animal on Earth. Like, are we in fact like the top of the animal chain, the pinnacle of evolution, if you like? Then a lot of the stuff about Hubbs is the senior scientist, right? He's sort of becomes monstrous over the course of the film, and it doesn't really make sense for that to happen in the context of like scientific derring do action.
No, exactly. Yeah, you Yeah, I think it's a very small cast film. You have Dr. Hubbs, played by Nigel Davenport, who is this senior scientist, biologist by specialization. He is like the one who initially discovers or researches, notices the behavior of these ants in this particular location, gets the funding and sort of proposals for this research on them. But other than him, you have James Lesko, who he hires to be his assistant, who is, I believe, a mathematician, or he's like an information specialist who like deals in like cryptography, that kind of thing. And then it is really just those two. And then you have the Eldridge family, who are like a local family living because it's a very sort of sparse desert area where they're at. You have this like, local family who are told to evacuate and obviously things don't go well for them. And one of those characters ends up kind of playing a role as well. But yeah, you have this very small cast. And as you say, Hubs becomes increasingly monstrous throughout this film as it kind of becomes a battle between him and the ants. And rather than trying to understand them, he kind of becomes obsessed with, I guess, like, defeating them or sort of maintaining superiority over them, and the movie does not go his way.
Yeah. I mean, maintaining superiority, I think, is a really good way of putting it, because there are all these exchanges between him and Lesko where Lesko's trying to kind of puzzle out what the ants are trying to plan and kind of what they're trying to communicate, because the ants start doing all of these things like erecting heat mirrors to cook them inside their science base, and interfering with their electronics so stuff doesn't work properly. But Hubs has all of these sort of like, no, we have to teach them to respect us. We have to prove to them that we're superior, or deliver them a defeat that they'll remember.
Right.
And it's always kind of in tension with Lesko trying to kind of puzzle out what they're saying to one another.
Yeah, it's very much this thing where I think, like, from the beginning, Hubs realizes that this is going to escalate into, like, a global problem, or this is going to become this big thing. But he's kind of trying to keep some of that to himself, at least initially. So Lesko is, like, just doing, he's there to do science. He's there to be the associate. He's been hired to do this job. He's applying his understanding of cryptography and information to try and decipher and communicate with these things. And there's Hubs, who's like just basically then trying to turn it into a war plan. Like the more intelligent these ants become, the more he kind of views it as like a war for survival.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very of its time thing in the sense that it reminds me a lot of other sort of generally countercultural things from the early 70s that are kind of making points about the Cold War, you know?
Yeah.
So I think you mentioned the daughter of the farming family. The way the farming family are dealt with is kind of indicative of Hubs's monstrosity, because he deploys this pesticide and the farming family sort of stumble into it, having had their farm attacked by ants, which is quite incredible to behold, because it's like the way that the ants are shown to coordinate to cause like massive damage despite being these tiny little things is incredibly impressive.
It really is, yeah.
But Hubs sort of views the family as kind of a curiosity once they stumble into the range of the pesticide and are killed by it.
Yeah, absolutely. You have this kind of thing where like they tell the family to evacuate, and I guess the way the narrative of these films usually go is you expect the family to really kind of like kick off and put their foot down. It's like, no, we've lived here for generations, we're not going to move, kind of thing. But actually, it's not quite like that. It's more there's a kind of a debate amongst them. You've got like the wife who doesn't really want to leave or doesn't quite understand, the husband who's saying like, well, you know, these scientists are telling us that we have to, so we probably should, but they don't quite understand the immediacy of the situation, and so are going to take a little bit of time to, you know, make this decision and get themselves together and you know, pack up and leave. And while that's happening, then yeah, they're beset by these ants. And as you say, ultimately they try and take shelter or reach the research facility. But because of the ants outside, Hubs deploys the I just want to go off on a slight tangent about the pesticide, if I can.
Oh, no, absolutely.
It's,
kind of,
it's indicative of something that I really like about this film, which is like, it's probably going to be a bit hit or miss for some people, but when it comes to like the science in this film and like, I don't know, people probably don't know much about me, but my background is physics. So I guess I am a scientist to some extent, and my education now, I'm a science teacher, but when it comes to like science in this film, there are aspects that it kind of goes into a little bit, mostly with like Lesko and the communication stuff, but as a general rule, it's very like intentionally vague in a way that I appreciate, because if it was like overly specific, you'd be able to kind of like nitpick things or go like, nah, that's not, you know, that's not very plausible or realistic. So like with the event that causes the ants to become intelligent in the first place, it is this like cosmic event that happens, and it's shown by, again, these like Sawbass kind of graphics at the start, but it's not really said what it is. It's not like, you know, oh, the Earth passes through the tail of a comet and this stuff happens. It's just like, no, there's weird shit happening in space. And with the pesticide, like they refer to it as 100% yellow. He's like, I'm going to deploy 100% yellow. And later in the film, there's a bit where it's like, oh, the ants have adapted to yellow chemistry. And it's like, this is an incense, like an intentionally kind of like vague nonsensical thing. And I just love that about it. So like the phrase 100% yellow has kind of always stuck with me after watching this film.
Yeah, it's cool. And I believe as well as yellow, they have blue. And you're right. It is that, like, it sounds plausible enough to be science-y enough to work, but there's not enough to
nitpick. Yeah, it's removed enough that you can't like point out anything specifically like, oh, you know, that chemical wouldn't do that, or that, you know, that it's just, you know, it's just, it's 100% yellow. Like, what is it? Well, it's 100% yellow. They don't say any more than that.
And I mean, it's also, it's not actually a million miles away from the way that people do refer to chemicals.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Like, if I found out that there was something that had industrial applications that was called 100% yellow, I wouldn't be that surprised.
No, exactly. Yeah, just, yeah, it works so well to kind of have this sort of just layer of vagueness that actually makes the science better, because it doesn't like take you out for being kind of implausible.
The other thing about 100% yellow is that it is literally 100% yellow. It's just
a
big cloud of bright primary yellow, which
it is, which is visually stunning.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, the thing about this movie is it is exactly like, once you realize you're watching someone whose background is in design and who goes on to be known primarily for design, a lot of the movie makes sense as like an opportunity to show you a really striking image or sequence of images.
Yeah, definitely. Like with the structures that the ants build and things as well, it's very it has this real kind of like alien otherworldliness to it. It's, you know, it takes itself like quite seriously, but also, yeah, it's very striking and just visually very interesting.
Yeah, because the scientists aren't operating in a lab in like a little concrete cinder block hut or something. They've got a dome made of tessellated metal triangles.
Yeah, it's like one of those like sort of eco dome things, like a mini eco dome. Yeah.
Yeah, and the pesticide comes out of these nodes that are at the end of like long pipes. So the entire thing, if you looked at it from above, would probably look like a diagram of a virus or something, you know?
Yeah, it's that kind of look, isn't it? It's they kind of like jut out on almost like limbs that sort of stick out from the center of the facility.
Yeah, and after they deploy the 100% yellow, what you then get is like this already kind of science fiction-y, space-y looking building, now surrounded by a perfect yellow circle.
Yeah. And it's a very striking, like, just graphic thing, isn't it? Which just makes perfect sense for Solbass.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mentioned a thing about the sort of increasing monstrosity of hubs, and there was a thing about that that I wanted to ask if kind of struck you the same way, which is just, if you watch many of Guillermo del Toro's movies, he has a habit of, like, gradually more and more disfiguring his villain as the movie goes on.
Yeah, yeah. And that is mirrored in Hubs, isn't it? Because he gets bitten by an ant quite early on, and then he's kind of, his arm starts to become deformed and he's hiding it from Lesko to begin with. There's a bit where an incident happens and Lesko bumps into him, and you see, like, he's, like, absolutely in pain from, like, Lesko just brushing up against this arm. And Lesko doesn't really notice because he's too preoccupied with what he's doing.
Who knows how and whether these things are communicated, but it would be fascinating to know if Guillermo del Toro saw this movie at some point, or if he just independently came up with, like, a guy neglecting an injury that gets more and more out of control as a kind of, like, visual signifier for someone who is, you know, obsessive and self-destructive and by extension kind of destructive to everyone around him.
Yeah, I guess I could sort of see it either way, because it's one of those things where if you're working in a visual media and you have this design sensibility, it's like you want to externalize, you want to show things through this visual thing. So I could see that different people with the same kind of mindset would arrive at the same kind of idea of doing that. But at the same time, it wouldn't surprise me if it's a 1974 movie, very visual cult following. It wouldn't surprise me if some people who went on to do other things had seen this.
It's a great shorthand for kind of undercutting Hubs's rationality as well, like, you know, making you doubt him as a scientist.
Yeah.
Because obviously the rational thing to do would be to try and deal medically with your ant bite so that you can continue your research or whatever you're doing. But he's so kind of driven by his quest to dominate them that he can't deal with it.
There is just like an urgency to him and his actions and things as well. And it's almost kind of like that he doesn't have time to worry about the arm, or, like, you know, whether it ends up, like, being, you know, fatal or ultimately or whatever. That's not kind of like his immediate concern at the moment. It's purely this sort of chess match, this battle that he's kind of engrossed himself in with these ants.
I think battle's the thing, right? Like, he's behaving like someone who's in a military situation more than he's behaving like a scientist at that point.
Yeah, and it takes Lesko a little while to kind of suss that part of him, because even from the very beginning of the film, like, Hubs is already in that mindset. He's just, like, initially doing his best to kind of seem like, you know, this is still about the research, and it's not really what it's about for him from the beginning.
Yeah. This is a fascinating conversation. We are coming up around about to the halfway point, so we will continue very shortly, but right now, we will take a brief break for some station messages.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. NPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out npr.nz for more information.
You are listening to Reserved Recommendations, a radio show and podcast about great trash and problematic faves. I am talking to Elizabeth Little tonight about the movie Phase 4, which is the only directorial credit from Saul Bass, a guy who you definitely know the work of, even if you don't immediately know that you know it, because he did the titles for too many movies to count. Before the break, we were talking about, I guess, the way that Hubs, the senior scientist's motivations are kind of questionable from the start. And I think the introduction of like the third human character kind of throws that into relief. She's the daughter of the farming family, and she's the only survivor of their encounter with the pesticide. And Hubs pretty much immediately, it seems like, decides that she's an inconvenience that needs to be disposed of.
Yeah, so that's Kendra Eldridge, who, yeah, during the incident with the 100% yellow, has taken like shelter in a sort of like a basement with like some wooden doors kind of covering it. But she emerges from that after the incident with the pesticide, when Hubs sort of finally stops spraying it, and they go outside to sort of, you know, assess the damage and assess what's happened. But yeah, no, she is an interesting character in that sense, and yeah, certainly Hubs and Lesko kind of. Her appearance on the base really kind of escalates the tension between them.
Yeah, I was, I guess because of the era of the movie, I was kind of expecting the disruption in the relationship to be more kind of focused on one or both of them becoming kind of sexually interested in her. That would be a very kind of 70s movie thing to do. But the movie kind of resists doing that.
Yeah, like you certainly get the sense that like it could go in that direction, and as you say, for this kind of era of movie and this kind of movie, that would be kind of like perhaps again like an expected kind of like narrative direction this would go in, but it's not. Yeah, it's not quite where it goes. Lesko certainly has this very kind of like protective attitude towards her, and at least like initially just. You know, wants her to be like evacuated to safety, and I think it's like Hubs who initially resists that, or just like it's, you know, it's not that's not their pressing concern. But then, yeah, it very much becomes like, oh, she's kind of in his way, or just like she's sort of immaterial to what's happening, and Lesko kind of fussing about her and sort of the whole situation. But I guess from Lesko's point of view, it also injects like some outside humanity back into the situation, which allows him to kind of see the contrast of what's happening with Hubs, and kind of, yeah, just like escalates that tension between them.
Yeah, because, I mean, they're in theory supposed to be under a contract, right? Like they're paid to do this research for a specific amount of time.
And yeah, that's right.
A certain point, Hubs has to get into fights, or, you know, get into arguments with people to continue their presence on the site.
Yeah, again, like you very much get this impression that he understands the magnitude of the situation here, and that it's going to escalate and become like a worldwide problem. But the people who are funding this research don't really have that view, or don't understand. And whether that's just because Hubs has been holding things back from them, or they've just like not understood what he's been saying, or they haven't had the time to properly like collate this data or make sense of it. But yeah, there's at least one point in the film where they're more or less told that, like, you know, the experiment is going to be wrapping up in like I can't remember if it's like another couple of weeks or something, but you know, there is only a certain amount of funding. They're only there for a certain amount of time. And unless they get something new, that's going to be it, which kind of then provokes Hubs to, well, provokes him to provoke the ants. He very much then attempts to antagonize them to cause something to happen which will allow the experiment to continue.
And that's what then starts the kind of escalating battle between the ants and the scientists, as the ants build structures and the scientists try and find ways to kind of counteract and attack them. Now, I do have a potential warning for people who might want to go and look out this movie. I watched it with my wife, who has some sensory stuff related to long COVID. And there is a sequence towards the sort of a bit past the middle where the scientists hit on the idea of trying to use essentially like resonant frequencies to try and cause collapses in the ants' tunnels or something.
I think that's what they were doing.
Or maybe to crack the heat mirrors, one of those things.
But yeah.
There's probably an 8 to 10 minute stretch of this movie where they play, because I'm a sound engineer, I have a spectrum analyzer app on my phone, so I dug it out. They play about, it's a pretty solid 4 kilohertz tone, which is the single frequency that the human ear is most sensitive to, for about 8 to 10 minutes, and it's really, really hard to sit through. My wife was just kind of had her hands over her ears on the couch going, tell me when they stop making that god-awful noise, and I'll continue watching this movie with you.
Imagine being trapped in a cinema with like a cinema sound system expecting a B movie, and you've gone in there with like, I don't know, popcorn and like a date or something, and it's just like, yeah, you're blasted with just the most horrendous sound, just a constant droning high pitch for 8 to 10 minutes.
Yeah, it really is quite unpleasant. If there is a single directorial decision I take issue with, it's probably
that's a good one.
For quite that long. But I mean, I always respect a really big swing, and I feel like this movie is an enormous swing, right?
Oh, it's extremely ambitious, especially with kind of like what it has to work with, because, you know, it is very much like, I mean, I want to call it a one set movie. Like, yeah, you do have the brief bit with the Eldridge, farmhouse and, some of the surrounding kind of like desert area. There's a bit right at the very end where they do like begin to go into the ant colony. But, you know, for the vast majority of this film, it is just inside this domed research base, and it is, again, like mostly a two person like production in terms of like the cast, and until you have Kendra introduced into the like the main group. It is like obviously not a particularly expensive movie, but it is like really, really like aiming to be like the 2001 A Space Odyssey of like the ant creature feature.
Yeah, absolutely. And based on a Ray Bradbury story, I think.
It might have been. I know it's based on. I think it's called Empire of the Ants. I can't remember who wrote it now. It could well be Ray Bradbury, but it is very, very loosely based. I think in that original adaptation, it's very much. I can't remember when it's set. I think it's more of like a sort of period thing of like finding strange ants out there in the jungle during kind of like colonial exploration kind of thing. But the ultimate idea is kind of similar in that you have these very intelligent, organized ants that end up becoming a threat that humans are like ill-equipped to deal with.
At this point, I guess spoilers for a movie from 1970, because I do kind of want to talk about the ending, because I think that's kind of where it all either comes together or falls to bits for you, because it's where Saul Bass shows his hand about what's been going on the entire time. So if you really don't want to be spoiled on a movie from 1970, like go watch it. You probably will need to put your pirate hat on if you're in New Zealand, because I couldn't find it anywhere. You can find the original ending just by itself on YouTube, but the actual movie is quite tricky to find.
Yeah, I did find that when I was looking. At least in the UK, it is available to purchase, at least not to view for free, but it is on Amazon Prime Video. I have a DVD of it from a while ago. I think it's from a like one of those collection ones. I don't remember if it's the Arrow collection, but it's like a horror collection, I think. I'd have to double check my DVD. I left it upstairs.
But however it is, what we have finally arrived at is that life becomes untenable inside the science dome. Hubs tries to kind of fight his way out and I think falls into a pit and is overcome by ants. Before that, Kendra goes out to kind of like sacrifice herself to the ants because she's decided that she's like the target of that's causing all of the hostility. So she's vanished. Hubs goes out and dies. And Lasko sets out by himself to find the ant colony and deliver pesticide, at which point he finds that Kendra is sort of sleeping in the sand there in suspended animation. And at that point, that's when it goes into the long Saul Bass, like running through hand-drawn mazes while we watch the sun emerge from various people's faces. And at one point, between a woman's legs as though she was giving birth to it. And it all gets intensely psychedelic, all of which to communicate that the ants are trying to condition people to be like proper vessels for kind of cosmic consciousness in the way that they are.
Yeah. Yeah, you have this fantastic scene at the end there, which is as you say, that there's like very much this theme of kind of, I want to say evolution, obviously, like in a strict sense, it's not evolution, but it's this idea of like the ants have become this raised intelligence and are interacting with humans. And in a way, they're very much studying the scientists. And, you know, we don't necessarily realize that initially. It kind of, you know, plays into that whole B movie, like, oh, the creatures want to take over the world and destroy us. But, you know, by the end, it's clearly revealed that that's not really the case. And it's more that the ants have been kind of researching humans, conducting an experiment, and then go about creating their new world order. And humans are a part of that and are kind of uplifted by the ants in some way, or as you say, like become vessels of this, like, same cosmic intelligence, which has uplifted them.
Yeah, yeah. And that, more than anything else, kind of strikes me as one of the most kind of intensely 70s sci-fi things about it. Like,
yeah, definitely.
I'm really struck and kind of moved by how utopian Saul Bass felt free to be in the 1970s about this kind of concept.
Yeah, it's an interesting one as well. Like those three scenes that you kind of mentioned, where you have like the death of Hubs, you have this like montage type sequence of Lesko arriving. He's looking for the ant queen. Like at this point, he very much believes they are like intelligent things. They could communicate, and understanding could be reached. But due to the actions of Hubs and the current situation, he's kind of come around to the idea that it's probably not possible, and so, perhaps against his own kind of better judgment or wishes, he tries to enact Hubs's final plan, which is to destroy the Ant Queen. So he goes out looking for it. But yeah, you have these three quite, I don't know, starkly different scenes. Like I always find that the death of Hubs is actually like quite anticlimactic. Like he emerges out to do this thing after being told by Lesko that, like, you know, you're in no fit state to be able to do this. And he almost immediately just like falls into a trap that the ants have set for him and dies. And that's just like, well, that's Hubs gone. And then, as you have Lesko on his own at that point, his then like suits up, he's wearing this protective suit with a mask, and he's like trudging across outside and beset by some difficulties at one point. You know, he sort of stumbles and his mask breaks, and it's almost kind of like a Tarkovsky-esque like stalker sequence, but like squeezed down into this little montage of him walking what is probably like not more than, I don't know, like 10 or 20 meters probably away from the dome. I can't remember quite how far away this is now, but it doesn't feel like he's gone that far.
No, no, he doesn't. I mean, you're right. The death of Hubs is very kind of immediate and anticlimactic, but it fits with the conception that the ants are trying to kind of like winnow down their three scientists to the ones who will be like amenable to their work. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah, like it makes perfect sense from that perspective. It's just like, again, it's one of those things where like, oh, the narrative convention of a film probably wouldn't do this to someone who it's kind of set up to be almost the antagonist, and he's disposed of so quickly. But it works in like the bigger context of what's going on.
Because, I mean, the entire point that Lesko's been trying to make for the entire movie is that the ants are operating on a level that they can't really understand. You know, he can intercept their messages and work out what they're saying to the worker ants that are doing stuff, but he can't discern the pattern behind it.
Yeah, I really love that. Like communication and language is like one of my big things that I'm really interested in, especially when it comes to stuff like alien first contact stories and things like that. I have a real pet peeve in sci-fi when it's like, oh, we've encountered this alien race that we've never come across before, and you know, within minutes or days, we are talking to them with some kind of like universal translator that we have created, or we've deciphered their language. Now we understand them perfectly, and it's like, even if you could understand the actual words, would you be able to actually understand them? It's like the psychology is going to be so alien and different, and very few works of visual sci-fi, certainly, and even in written sci-fi, it's quite uncommon. But certainly in visual sci-fi, it's extremely uncommon to come across that kind of thing presented well. And here you have a film which is like not even strictly speaking about aliens. It's like, yes, there is this cosmic event which has caused the ants to become uplifted and to have this kind of like alien-like intelligence. And you know, maybe there is a like an alien cause to this ultimately. Like, we don't know. The movie doesn't, you know, go into that for the better, I think. But yeah, you have these ants presented in a way which is like what feels more like an authentic first contact with aliens kind of scenario than like pretty much any film I can think of that actually does have a first contact with aliens.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you know any people whose first language is not English, you will encounter the phenomenon of people trying to like directly translate idioms into English. Yeah. I have some Dutch friends. A Dutch friend of mine would say when she got really mad, it brings the blood from under my fingernails, which makes perfect sense in Dutch, but makes you sound deranged in English. And that's between like creatures of the same species, you know, like it's yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. The idea that aliens would be like remotely like understandable to us on that kind of like cultural and just in terms of like, you know, the metaphors that they would use or just the logic behind their thinking. And I love the way that this movie presents that, because it's like, yes, they can establish some kind of communication, but at no point are they ever actually able to like perfectly understand each other or sort of decipher exactly what's going on. It's very much this demonstration of intelligence and like suggestions of communication, but lacking that actual like understanding, which I just really appreciate that it does that. I'm a big fan when it comes to like literary science fiction of like Peter Watts and stuff like that. So things like Blindsight, which also deals with like first contact between extremely alien aliens. So it's very much my kind of vibe.
Have you read Embassy Town?
Yes.
Yes.
Love that too.
Good, yeah. Good. I mean, look, I, this is the thing that I wanted to compliment you on specifically as well. The reason that I know of you at all is that you wrote a game called You Will Die in This Place. And one of the things in there is this system of like classifying intelligences and styles of communication, which I had never come across before and kind of blew my mind all the way out of my head as a way of like classifying entities that you might come across in a sci-fi or fantasy setting. Just, an incredible way of expressing that idea.
Oh, thank you. I was very, I was very happy with that one. It was one of those things where, I guess that to people who are not familiar with it, if they are familiar with the role-playing game Dungeons & Dragons and the whole kind of like alignment system, the thing that is being referred to here is like kind of a parody of that, but it's also not. It's like you say, it's very much about setting up this whole thing of like linguistics versus culture, and how you can have a shared language, or you can understand the words, but you might not be able to understand the actual intelligence, the culture, the thoughts behind that, or vice versa. You know, you might be able to have a language which, you know, due to either like, you know, biology or various things, like you physically cannot share words with each other, but the behaviors and cultures behind those very different languages could actually be quite similar. So I wanted to have a grid that did that. I was quite happy that, you know, people did pick up on that, that it was like, you know, more than just me kind of like having a bit of a dig at Dungeons and Dragons, which I was also doing.
But. Yeah, I mean, look, you cannot occupy the cultural position that that Dungeons and Dragons does without people taking shots at you. So, you know, in my view, any shot at Dungeons and Dragons is kind of always justified, even if it's a bad shot, and that was a good one. But that idea that you could – that you could encounter a being and both of you could be, you know, finger quotes, intelligent, but the nature of the intelligence could be such that your relationship, you know, can't ever be kind of directly communicative.
You could have this thing which, despite being as intelligent as you, is just completely just not possible to understand. Just the language and the culture and the thinking behind it is just so alien that it is just not possible to find that common ground, even if you could understand the words, and you know, perhaps you also can't do that, which just makes it even more difficult.
Well, look, thank you so much for putting this very odd little movie on my on my radar. It is a thing that I am going to absolutely reservedly recommend to people, because
I do hope more people watch it, because when you pitched this to me, it was very much like, can you bring and you know, talk about something which I think the way you worded it initially was like, it's bad but you love it anyway. And it's like, well, I suggested Phase 4. I was talking to my friend Errol at the time, and I said that, oh, I kind of want to talk about Phase 4, and Errol was like, but Phase 4 isn't bad. It's like, it's really, really good. It's like, I know it's really good, but also like, it was perceived as being bad at the time. And I thought that was kind of like an interesting twist on that, just because of the way it was so badly kind of like mismarketed and pitched. And it is this very strange, kind of like not particularly well-known film. So I do hope people do go out and watch it, because it is genuinely very good.
Yeah, it is. Although, I mean, it's good in a way that is, I guess, slightly audience hostile, you know, like,
oh God, yeah.
It is
certainly not for everyone.
It is going to play you a 4 kilohertz tone for 8 to 10 minutes. It is going to, you know, it takes its time setting things up. You spend a fair bit of time with Hubs and Lesko just kind of like wandering around the desert looking at grass.
The directing of the people is certainly not as good as the directing of the ants.
And so, like, altogether, I think it does deserve its cult following, but it's, you know,
certainly some people are going to watch it and go like, what was that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, if you've got like, I don't know, like Tarkovsky, Jodorowsky, like Kubrick, those kinds of things that are your thing, then this is kind of like the low budget and horror movie for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I would put this in a category with movies like Zardoz as well.
I could see that.
A staunch Zardoz defender. The peak of Sean Connery's career.
Another one that overreaches, but yeah.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But you know, in the same way that this kind of sticks in your head, the gun is good, the penis is evil, is one of those phrases, yeah, which is like obviously absurd, but the more you sit with it, kind of the more, yeah, actually, I get why, yeah, I'm okay.
it's one of those phrases that has stuck with me, and yeah, just like how I will occasionally refer to things as 100% yellow, and it's like,
yeah,
not many people understand why I suddenly find that very funny, but yeah, it's these kind of movies have that lasting effect.
So, by way of wrapping up, are there things that you would recommend if people have watched Phase 4 or they go and watch Phase 4, which, you know, to be clear, you should if you can. Like, are there things you would put with it as a double feature? Are there things that you would say fit in the same kind of zone?
Oh, God. Right. This is like particularly relevant and also somewhat annoying. Because I mentioned that when I suggested talking about Phase 4 in here, I was talking to my friend Errol. Errol and I have a thing where we watch double features. So mm-hmm. we will, every week or two, we'll meet up at mine and we'll watch two films back to back. And usually we try and do it where I've suggested one and Errol has suggested the other one. Occasionally it'll be like we've both suggested one, or for whatever reason it doesn't quite work that way. But it's always very much around the same theme. And I could not for the life of me remember what we had paired Phase 4 with, and neither could Errol, but we were talking about a few things that we had sort of seen around the same time, and I think we came up with ones that like we'd paired with other things than Phase 4, so I cannot remember what we paired with it, but things like Altered States.
Oh, yes.
Beyond the Black Rainbow, which is a more modern film, but it's filmed very much in the way of like a 1970s kind of psychedelic crazy film. I would very much recommend. I would certainly recommend the visuals of that one. Oh God, what else did we watch around the same time? Because I think we paired those two together. Actually,
I have a pitch for a horrendous mismarketing pairing rather than a thematic pairing. Yeah. Which would be to double feature this with Jennifer's Body.
Yeah, I can see that, yeah.
Movies which were done dirty by the marketing department.
Yeah, again, that was a movie that I had completely ignored because I thought that does not seem like it's a movie for me, and I watched it and I actually quite liked it.
Yeah, absolutely. It was sold in a way that meant that the people who went to see it hated it and the people who would have liked it didn't go to see it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I guess that things like Stalker, Annihilation, again, I think we paired those two together rather than with Phase 4, but it's that kind of just high concept science fiction. As far as books and things go as well, like Embassy Town, Shrine of Evil, and like Blindsight, Peter Watts, like definitely that kind of vibe.
Yeah, Annihilation actually would be another good companion. You know, another movie where you spend a long time feeling like your head is going slowly wrong. So, last thing, do you have stuff to plug? Do you have things that you would like people to come and check out?
I guess You Will Die in This Place is the big one at the moment, which it's like the crowdfunding for that is all wrapped up and done now. We're in the process of sending out the books and bits and pieces. We posted like I think 77 copies last week, and I posted some of the other little bits and pieces that went with the crowdfunding. There's more going out, but that will be that's already available for like digital download on either my itch.io or it's up on RPG Trader as well, which is quite a new site that's gone up recently that seems quite popular. And there's going to be a print on demand version on RPG Trader as well. I haven't made that live yet because I'm waiting for my copy to arrive first just so I can do like a quality check on it. But my understanding is that they print through, Lulu, who has quite a good reputation as a print-on-demand service, so I'm anticipating that that will all be fine, and probably in a week or two that will be available for purchase as a colour hardback from there and on print-on-demand as well.
Amazing. And just, I was entirely sincere when I said that You Will Die in This Place blew my brain all the way out. It is really cool. If you are remotely interested in tabletop role-playing games, you should take a look at it. It is really neat. thank you once again for joining me this evening, Elizabeth. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you very much for having me. Always love talking about Facebook.
You've been listening to Reserved Recommendations, a radio show and podcast from Manawatu People's Radio, Te Reo Irirangi o Ngā Tangata o Manawatu. The show was produced and edited by me, Hugh Dingwall, and I also composed our theme music. It's called Sack Jazz, and you can find it at wolfboy.bandcamp.com. If you enjoyed this episode, why not share it with a friend? You can find past episodes at npr.nz/show/reserved or wherever fine pods are cast. You can find me on Blue Sky at Objective Reality, and you can follow the show on Instagram and Facebook.